Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Listener, Obscura is supported by listeners like yourself. If you'd like to support Obscura, then head to patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast. That's patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast. You'll get early access to episodes, including part two to this two-part series before anyone else. And just on a personal note, I've had a lot of expenses recently regarding the hurricanes and a major move. So any support is very appreciated. That said, if you are not financially in a place to support the show, I completely understand. Just sit back and enjoy the podcast. All right, let's get on with it. Listener, do you ever take a moment to recognize how much in your life you take for granted? Every now and again, especially if I'm feeling a little down on myself, maybe a little whiny, I like to remind myself of the tools I was gifted at birth, and that there are those of us in life much less fortunate than I am. I say all this in prelude to the fact that this episode covers the hearing impaired, and I want to say up front that I recognize that Obscura has listeners who are hearing impaired, and I've done my best here to cover this disability with respect. Still, it goes without saying that even the best intentioned can sometimes stumble. Listener, know this. If I say anything in this episode that is considered offensive to the hearing impaired, then it was not intentional. In fact, feel free to reach out and correct me, and I'll happily clean up any missteps on my part. With that said, let's get on with it.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Helen Keller. Part 1. The Sanctuary of Silence. The illusion of security was true for Gallaudet University. Situated in the heart of some of the worst neighborhoods in Washington, D.C., has to offer, at the time of the murders, at least. The campus was surrounded by wrought iron fencing. On-site security regularly roamed the campus in a bid to thwart any unusual activity that may occur on school grounds. For the students and faculty, Gallaudet existed in a bubble, void of the perils of the outside world. But the killings, however, would highlight that there's nowhere in the natural world that is impervious to the possibility of danger, even somewhere as unassuming as Gallaudet University. It was fall 2000. Ben Varner, a college freshman, first stepped foot on a Gallaudet's campus. A man who thrived in scholastic studies, despite his disability. It was in San Antonio, Texas, 1982, where Ben attended Sunshine Cottage School for the Deaf to begin speech and audiological training. Ben later transferred to Oak Grove Elementary School in the third grade, where he scored top marks. That was the thing with Ben. Like many deaf people before him, he didn't let the disability define him. And Ben, when it came to test scores, never saw a B. At MacArthur High School, he continued to excel in academics, including Spanish, history, geography, religion, accounting, and the sciences. He, of course, graduated from MacArthur High School, and in August 2000, he was granted a scholarship to the world-renowned Gallaudet University. Founded in 1864, at the time of writing this, Gallaudet is the only liberal arts college designed to accommodate the needs of the hearing impaired. One look at the state-of-the-art campus, and it becomes difficult to believe that just several hundred years ago, the notion of an all-deaf institution of higher learning would have been met by mockery and skepticism. Without the ability to communicate, the deaf were once considered to be without the ability to reason. Even Plato, the father of Western philosophy, believed that without speech, one had no outward sign of intelligence, and therefore the deaf, according to Plato, were incapable of understanding reasoned arguments or language. The idea would be taken further in the Dark and Middle Ages, when the deaf were believed to have been possessed by the devil. A child born deaf was said to be punishment for the sins of their parents. The hearing impaired were medically treated similar to those who suffered mental illnesses, and it wasn't uncommon for deaf mutes to be institutionalized. It wasn't until the 1700s that the idea that the deaf could be educated, if they could learn a way to communicate, would be accepted by mainstream society. Oddly enough, it would be the religious who became the biggest supporters of the deaf education, believing that denying the hearing impaired the ability to read and write would be denying them the right to religious scripture and an opportunity to cast out the demons that were possessing them. While Europe explored oratory methods, it would be right here in the United States where sign language would become the standard for deaf education. Before it was known as a bougie resort for wealthy New Englanders, the island of Martha's Vineyard had been inhabited by English immigrants from the county of Kent. Those born in this region carried a recessive gene for hereditary deafness. By the early 1800s, one in 155 children born on the island would be born deaf. In order to adapt to the high number of deaf inhabitants, the citizens of Martha's Vineyard developed their own version of sign language to communicate. These signs would later lay foundation for American Sign Language and would be taught for the first school for the deaf, established in Hartford by Thomas Hopkins Gallaudet in 1817. A statue of Gallaudet and Alice Cogswell, a deaf girl who inspired Gallaudet to create America's first all-deaf school and had been his first student, now stands at the front of Gallaudet University's campus to welcome students like Ben Varner into an environment steeping in deaf culture. To put it shortly, Gallaudet is considered a mecca for the deaf, and students who have spent most of their lives living in a world designed for the hearing, in spite of the inclusive environment Gallaudet provides for deaf and hard of hearing. The university has seen some dark days. On August 16, 1980, Gallaudet would experience a murder on campus for the first time in the school's 116-year history. Benson Hall was your typical co-ed college dorm. It saw many parties, pranks, and other shenanigans you would expect to see on a college campus. So it was unusual for Jamie Wildling to head over to the dorm room of Douglas Woodward after midnight on a Saturday. The details of what transpired between Wildling and Woodward within the span of half an hour's time are unclear. What is known is that Wildling had been stabbed before he was thrown from Woodward's 8th floor window. Woodward would be charged with second-degree murder and ordered to serve a 15-year sentence for Wildling slaying in exchange for a guilty plea. The murder of Wildling would strike fear in the hearts of incoming freshmen, and college administrators issued letters to parents reassuring them that the case was unique to the Gallaudet experience. Time would pass, and the memories of the frightful August night began to fade. Students came and went. Douglas Woodward would see his release day, and Gallaudet would return to being a sanctuary of silence. Listener, you know better, don't you? There is no sanctuary of silence. Death is always around the corner, waiting for you. You could find yourself working in a coffee booth in an isolated area of Anchorage, Alaska. Or maybe hiking a dilapidated bridge in the Midwest with your friend, looking for Instagram photo opportunities. Death is always around the corner. So listener, exactly 20 years after Jamie Wildling was stabbed 20 times by his classmate and launched out a window, death would return to Gallaudet University. Part 2. The Chair. After being awarded a scholarship to attend Gallaudet, Ben Varner traveled to Washington, D.C. from his home state of Texas. He was shy and quiet compared to some of the other students on campus, but a party hosted for new students was quick to change that. A small cafe known as the Abbey, and where Ben would become acquainted with fellow students, Eric Plunkett, the outgoing type, Joseph Mesa, soft, quiet, but large and imposing, and Thomas Minch, a bit of a jokester. With the exception of Thomas, the young men learned they were all residents of Cogswell Hall, and together, the group decided to nickname the west wing of the dorm the Wild Wild West. This shared moment would mark the beginning of four lives that would become tragically intertwined. For an introvert like Ben, the adjustment for Gallaudet had been a difficult one. His mother doted on him since he was a child and dedicated her life to helping Ben learn to function in a hearing world. Even with the help of hearing aids and devoted parents, Ben found school to be exhausting. Though Ben excelled as a student, there were many days when Ben would come home from school and go straight to bed. Gallaudet was an opportunity for Ben to continue his education while taking away the pressure to live up to the standards set forth by the world of the hearing. At Gallaudet, he was no longer at a disadvantage on account of his disability. He was just like everyone else on campus. But that came with a price, listener. You see, gone was the chip on his shoulder. As you recall, Ben never saw a B. That was one of the motivating factors for him, being in the world of the hearing. That burning passion ignited at his core, the one that refused to allow him to be seen as less than any of his classmates. The trouble here is that Ben was now surrounded by those who grew up with similar struggles. He wasn't the odd duck out. It sort of took the spice out of outdoing those around him. And although Ben had been excited about starting a new chapter at Gallaudet, being away from his mother was tough for him. She was there for him through all those years, helping him whenever he stumbled, whenever he was troubled, whenever he needed help. In his first few days, his mom helped him settle into his room at Cogswell Hall. Staying in a nearby campus hotel, Ben came to her room the night before she was due to return to Texas. Ben sat down on his mother's bed and cried. Though Ben continued to email his mother every day, making new friends made his adjustment on campus life a little more bearable, and he passed his spare time tutoring other students in math. Tutoring was that comfort zone he needed. He learned to turn the spite he held against his former hearing classmates into a desire to see his fellow hearing impaired friends succeed. They were going to light the world ablaze, and no one was going to stop them. Just as Ben and the other residents of Cogswell Hall were beginning to find a sense of community at Gallaudet, having parties and staying up late, drinking, talking ambitions, the slaying of one of the Wild Wild West members, Eric Plunkett, changed everything in an instant. The campus-tight security measures made the possibility of a murderer coming in from outside very unlikely. Everyone on campus knew whoever had killed Eric Plunkett had to have been one of their own. And that was a very frightening prospect indeed, listener. Eric Plunkett, as a reminder, was a member of the Wild Wild West. And he was born in 1981. He was born in Portland, Oregon, to Craig and Kathy Plunkett. He grew up in Hillsboro in Portland until he was 16. Then he moved with his mother and stepfather back to Minneapolis in 1996. He was profoundly deaf and had cerebral palsy in his legs. Eric went to public schools in Portland. In the seventh grade, he went to school at the Oregon School for the Deaf down in Salem, a residential school for the deaf. Then went to Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf in Faribault, Minnesota for 3 years. Graduated in May 2000. Then started at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. as a freshman in August of 2000. On Thursday, September 29th, 2000, around 9 p.m., students entered Plunkett's dorm room to check up on him after not having seen or heard from him all day. In fact, it was a full 24 hours that would pass before the dorm's RA would walk in on the grisly scene. Eric's door had been closed and locked. This was highly unusual for him, since he often left the door open. He was good-natured. He enjoyed having other residents pop in and chat or borrow from his extensive video collection. Just an all-around sociable guy. While Eric's closed door raised some suspicions, it was a sickly sweet smell coming from the room that was ultimately what would alert Eric's friends and fellow Cogswell Hall resident, Joseph Mesa, that something was not quite right. Joseph Mesa ran to the RAs to alert them about the strange odor, and they were able to retrieve the master key. Door partially ajar, spots of blood began to come into view, growing larger as they drew closer to the body of Eric Plunkett, who was found sprawled across his dorm room floor. Pictures of his baby sister, dotted with blood spatter, juxtaposed with Eric's battered, bruised, mangled, and bloody body, made one thing clear. His death was no accident, and he did not go easy. Plunkett's body was transported to D.C. General Hospital, where the medical examiner pronounced him dead and ruled the cause of death as homicide. Eric's body was covered with bruises, gashes, and all-around trauma. Covered in contusions and blood, his body left mangled. Eric looked unrecognizable. The autopsy report concluded that, despite suffering many injuries, Plunkett died from blunt force trauma to the head and a broken neck. The medical examiner believed that the suspect had used a chair in the room to kill Plunkett. The chair was blood spattered, had skin residue, and clumps of hair attached, meaning that someone had taken Eric's chair and proceeded to beat him with it over and over again, relentlessly, and with such force that it broke Eric's neck, ultimately killing him. And Saturday, September 30th, 2 days after Plunkett's body was found, the detectives continued interviewing students. One witness, whom the police identified as Witness 1, told the police that Plunkett had a romantic relationship with a Thomas B. When the police later re-interviewed Witness 1 along with another witness, the second witness told the police that Thomas's last name began with M and not B. After going through the school roster, the police presented Witness 2 with a photo of appellant Thomas Minch. The witness positively identified Minch as the person who was involved with Plunkett. In case you forgot, Thomas Minch was a member of the Wild Wild West friend group. Part 3. Motives.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? And sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Though at the time, the motive was unknown, it was rumored that Eric's murder had been a hate crime. In the weeks leading up to the discovery of Eric's body, Gallaudet had experienced a wave of anti-homosexual graffiti scribbled around campus, making many openly LGBT students at the university feel unsafe. On Friday, September 29th, Detective Kyle Camotti and other detectives under his supervision interviewed an estimated 11 students in the dorm. A number of students told the police that Plunkett was gay and was a member of the Gay and Lesbian Club on campus. The detectives also interviewed Eric Plunkett's family, specifically asking them about Eric's computer, which was turned on and logged in when Eric's body was found. The family said that Eric used the digital camera that was attached to the laptop to video conference with them. His mother told the police that Plunkett suffered from a mild case of cerebral palsy. Just before his murder, Eric had been appointed secretary of the Limbada Society, an organization for LGBT campus activism. Several members had been met by hurtful comments about their sexuality from other students, but the abuse didn't stop there. Vandals left handwritten homosexual slurs on classroom whiteboards. Dorms of openly LGBT students were also targets of hateful graffiti reflecting angry, anti-homosexual sentiments. One student told the Washington Post that the once news of Eric's murder spread through campus. Students met in a plaza to discuss what happened with grief counselors on hand. One student was witnessed signing to another student, "Oh good, one less faggot," upon hearing the news. It was alleged that another student nodded in approval. For LGBT students, they believe there was little doubt that Eric's murder had been part of a hate campaign that had been sweeping through the hallowed halls of Gallaudet University, and they quickly went to work strategizing methods to ensure their safety. For Ben, the news of Eric's murder hit him hard. Eric was one of his first friends on the campus and a fellow Cogswell Hall resident. Police investigating the case determined that Eric had been beaten to death with a chair. It was unlikely that Eric, who in addition to being deaf, suffered from cerebral palsy, was able to fight off his attacker. An investigator worked to piece together clues on who could have committed such a heinous act against a student who was generally well-liked by his peers. A memorial service was held in his honor. Quote, "Eric touched the lives of people from coast to coast," Eric's stepfather said in a prepared speech. "His life is one to be celebrated with joy." Thomas Minch and Joseph Mesa also stood in front of the crowd of mourners to share their memories of Eric. Ben, true to his quiet nature, declined walking the stage alongside his Wild Wild West brethren, but mourned his passing privately in his own way. Joseph Mesa was also quietly mourning in his own private way, with joy. At age 22, and from Guam, Joseph Mesa is large for his age. With large arms and a stocky frame, he is known for being quiet. But in him brews something dark. At night, when no one is around, Mesa likes to scour the campus and neighborhood. You see, he's on the hunt, on the prowl, and with enough diligence, Joseph Mesa would find stray cats. His favorite being kittens, or, better yet, mother cats with a fresh batch of kittens. There, in the dark of the night, Joseph Mesa would torture the cats to death, sometimes beating them furiously and without thought, but frequently taking his time, breaking their bones or ripping off hunks of their fur or muscle. Those in earshot likely chalking the screams of the felines down to stray cats fighting in the night. This is something that Mesa has done since childhood, a story he will one day recount to a psychiatrist with a smile and a glint in his eye. Because behind Joseph Mesa's quiet exterior is a sociopath. And unfortunately for the quiet and tranquil surrounding of Gallaudet University, the police don't suspect our Joseph Mesa for a second. In fact, listener, they are on the wrong trail, and they have their own prejudices to blame for this. Police believed they had already narrowed in on the likely suspect. But listener, they couldn't be more wrong. And while the police focus their energy on the wrong suspect, a silent killer walks the school halls. A large man with a sick mind in an environment that couldn't be more beneficial for a serial killer rising up, in which his next victim won't and can't hear him coming. On the next episode of Obscura, we cover the preventable bloodshed that is to come, the fallout, the trial, and the impact on the victims. But for now, I think that wraps things up. I thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.
Are you ready to get serious about your weight loss journey? Tried crash and burn calorie restriction? Considering the invasive strategy of GLP-1 injections like Ozempic? Slow down and consider a safer, easier, and long-lasting solution. Golo is clinically proven to work without the dangerous side effects of injections and fad diets. Golo's release helps your body combat the stress of dieting while controlling cravings and hunger. Minimize muscle loss and feel better with Golo. Just take one Golo Release supplement with each meal and follow the Golo for Life plan. It's an effective and affordable plan to lose weight for good. There are no insurance hoops to jump through. No prescription needed. Just sensible, effective weight loss and a healthier lifestyle on your terms. Get started on a healthier, happier, and more energetic you at Golo.com. 5 million people have already discovered a better way to lose weight. Join them and go to Golo.com. That's GOLO.com today.